Dear listeners, hello and thank you for joining us for this 247th edition of Sudbury News Talk magazine. My name is Michelle Mandry and I will be your presenter today. I gave our contributors only a very vague topic for this edition: bees and or honey, birds, springtime, wildflowers, the old Whitsuntide, or anything at all. They fall into two broad camps: springtime and wildflowers, but still a delightful mix of reminiscence and observations. To begin at the beginning, Margaret Hibble introduces us to the whole idea of springtime in a piece kindly read for us by Margaret King.
Springtime. Firstly, what do we mean by springtime? In the UK, we usually follow the meteorological seasons, which mean that springtime is from the 1st of March until the 31st of May. Our three warmest months are called summer, and the three coldest months are winter, and the gaps between are spring and autumn. In some other parts of the world, the seasons are very different, especially in tropical areas, where they only have rainy or dry seasons. Wordsworth's famous poem, "I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud," written in 1802, sums up beautifully the first signs of spring. "I wandered lonely as a cloud that floats on high o'er vales and hills, when all at once I saw a crowd, a host of golden daffodils, beside the lake, beneath the trees, fluttering and dancing in the breeze." Springtime is surely the best season of the whole year. After the long dark days of winter, which this year seemed darker and wetter than ever, what a thrill it was to see the first daffodil. We heard the first happy bird song in our garden. The sparrows that live in the honeysuckle near the house seemed to chatter and squabble all day long. One of the loudest birds is the blackbird, which sings from the tops of the trees. And if you listen carefully, you can hear the answering call from a nearby garden. Robins sing sweetly and love to follow us around as we work in the garden, always hoping we will unearth a tasty worm. The springtime garden even smells different. The apple trees are full of blossom this year, filling the garden with their beautiful scent. Lots of spring flowers are blooming early in the warm sunshine we have been enjoying during the last few weeks. The sweet-smelling lilac is in full bloom, and even lily of the valley are shyly peeping through. We mustn't forget the animal kingdom, as many creatures wake from their long winter hibernation. Birds are busy building nests all around the garden, always preferring the dense growth of ivy to the smart nest boxes we have provided. As we go out and about, there are newborn lambs in the fields and baby ducklings swimming on the pond in my daughter's garden, not forgetting newly emerging butterflies and busy bees as they search for nectar in the spring flowers. As we head towards June and the start of the season of summer, and we look forward to longer, warmer days, don't let us forget the beautiful days of springtime that we have just enjoyed.
Thank you, Margaret Hibble. The whole world does seem to come alive, doesn't it, after the quiet of winter? And thank you, Margaret King, for the lovely reading. Also pleased that spring has returned, here's Ken Watkins.
Spring is always welcome. The end of grey days, hopefully. The clocks going forward, where they should stay. Lighter evenings. All combining to lift the spirits, if winter has been mainly cold and damp. And then I look at the garden and think about the tasks that lie ahead. Our garden here in Barry has been something of a voyage of discovery. The people who owned the house for some 30 years before we bought it planted a lot of stuff that I certainly don't recognise, and a lot my wife suggested we dig out, which we have done every spring, although some of the unwanted vegetation comes back year after year, and sometimes something we didn't know was there rears its far from beautiful head. And the springtime labour of Hercules starts all over again. I must confess, I'm not really a fan of gardening, whatever the season. I'm quite happy to go and look, and we've visited a fair number of gardens in our time, major formal ones, and, when we lived in Suffolk, those which support charities on open garden days. I stand in awe of some of the achievements, Bodmont Gardens and Port Meirion in North Wales, for example. And last year we spent a week in Herefordshire, taking in several impressive formal gardens. The latter were well worth the visit, with the enjoyable tea and cake rounding off the day perfectly. In Guernsey some years ago, we took time to visit Victor Hugo's garden, which is maintained by France, and that was a delightful couple of hours. The thought and time that has been put into designing gardens like that certainly impress. But we were also, on that tour of Guernsey, invited to look at a prize-winning domestic garden. I'm afraid I have to confess, the serried ranks of flowers there simply left me cold. My mother's garden was always colourful, but not regimented, and my wife takes the same approach. But Judy has always managed to produce, shall we say, an interesting garden. Wherever we've lived in England and Wales, no matter what the vagaries of the soil. When it comes to gardens, I'm a vegetable plot man and no expert on flowers or shrubs. Show me two similar looking plants and ask me to identify the weed and I'll probably guess wrong. But put me on a vegetable plot any time of the year and I'm happy. When I was working in Lancashire, which is where our children were born in the 1970s, we had a bungalow on the edge of the village, right next to a field which had horses in it. So I had a regular supply of manure to improve the soil in the vegetable plot, and it flourished. When we first moved to Alfeton in 1999, we had a very large garden, 2 acres in all. Many years earlier, it had been a small holding, but the people we bought the house from owned horses, and they'd divided the land into paddocks, one with a stable block. Twice in the 12 years we lived there, we were able to rent out the land for lengthy spells to people who needed somewhere to keep their horses, and I didn't have to worry about the grass growing wild. In the spring, if we didn't have horses, I had the thrill, if that's the word, of firing up my ride-on mower in a bid to keep things under control. A couple of hours driving round in ever-decreasing circles was great fun initially, although by the autumn, the magic had certainly worn off. Lovely though that first garden in Alfeton was, and how much we enjoyed the harvest of vegetables, as our investment in a large polytunnel more than paid off. After retirement, we came to our senses and downsized to something in the village, which was, I'm glad to say, a little more manageable. And when we moved to Barry in 2020, we took some plants with us. In different and very shallow soil, some thrived, but others were overwhelmed by what had been there for so many years previously. Sadly, no veg plot, as the garden is far too small. But the strawberry plants brought from Suffolk have done well, and as the springtime weather in Barry has been a mix of sunshine and the right amount of rain, we have high hopes, even before spring officially turns to summer on June the 21st, of enjoying the first of many feasts.
Thank you, Ken. I think vegetable plots can be just as attractive as flower gardens, especially to pollinating insects. On which note, I'm really pleased now to introduce our guest this evening, beekeeper Alec Wisby, who is here to share his enthusiasm for bees. Alec.
If you're out in the garden this time of year, you'll probably hear the buzz of many bees flitting from flower to flower, collecting pollen and nectar to take back to their colony. If you see these bees, they'll only be female bees. All the workers are female bees. The male bees don't do any work. The female bees are collecting pollen, nectar, water and propolis, which is tree sap. These are the four things they bring back to the colony. If you ever see a male bee, its eyes are much larger, compound eyes, so they can find a queen bee, a virgin queen bee in flight, but they won't do any work. And it's a one-time thing. If they mate with a queen, they then expire. There's only one time it will happen. But then if they get to the winter, the female bees will bite their wings off and throw them outside the hive. This is because they don't actually do any work inside the colony. So they're not really needed during the winter time, so there's no mating. The bees are collecting nectar, which they need to invert into honey. They have to take out most of the liquid content of the water. It's about 80-odd% of nectar is water. And they need to reduce this down to less than 20% to turn it into honey so it will keep for the whole winter. If they don't do this, they will go off and they can't use it. I'm surprised actually by so many people that don't realise that the honey's for the bees themselves and not for people. So many people have asked me, what do they do with it? And it's only us beekeepers that bother them and take the honey away from them. And you have to replace that for them. You have to give them sugar syrup. I don't normally take all the honey away from the bees because I think it's slightly unfair. If you take away all that hard work and you replace it with sugar syrup, which is basically water and sugar together, it's like if someone had come around my house and taken all the chocolate out of the fridge and then left me with cabbages. And I wouldn't be very happy. And I'm pretty sure the bees prefer to have honey rather than sugar syrup. But it's a very busy time of year for me. I'm all out at the moment. I'm collecting swarms. If you imagine you've got a swarm hanging up in a tree, they're looking for a home. And I'll find a nice home for them and a box to put them in, and they're very happy. If you try to remove them from somewhere, like a building, which I've done before, they're not so happy about being moved. Again, it's like people. If you give somebody a new home, they're very happy. But if you try to move them from a home they're currently in and very happy with, it's slightly more difficult. I've used hoovers before to remove bees from buildings. Not a regular hoover. You have to have some mesh across into a plastic box so you can suck the bees into the box and then remove them into a hive. Otherwise, it wouldn't go very well. So at the moment, the bees are trying to build up. Over the winter, the queen will have stopped laying and there'll be less bees. And the bees won't go into full adulthood. The worker bees stay quite juvenile because they've only got to look after the colony. They don't have to fly. So it's later, say, in the spring then, they're flying, they're collecting nectar. They won't last as long as winter bees. Winter bees will only last... winter bees will last, say, 2 to 3 months, whereas the spring bees will last for 6 weeks. They wear themselves out back and forth with all the flights to bring the nectar back to the colony. The queen bee will stay inside the colony unless it's decided that she is going to swarm. And she doesn't really decide. The colony decides for her. They'll stop feeding her so much so she can slim down for a flight. And it's the only case, really, where the adults leave and leave the young, rather than for us, the young leave the nest and move on where the parents stay where they are. But this is how they reproduce. The queen will take the swarm with her only after they've left new queen cells inside the colony. You can only have one queen in a colony. If there's more queens that hatch out at the same time, there will be a fight. If they don't hatch it at the same time, the first queen out will sting the others because there can only be one queen inside that colony. She will be the only one that lays eggs. unless she starts to lose her queen pheromone. The queen pheromone inhibits the female workers from laying eggs, but because she's the only one that's been mated, when she lays eggs, she can pick if it's a worker, which is a fertilised egg, or a drone, which is an unfertilised egg. So that makes the difference between the female or male bees. If the queen pheromone goes and she's getting older and they've not been replaced, then the worker bees can start laying eggs, and a beekeeper will spot this because you'll see many more eggs inside the cells rather than the queen just laying one egg in the bottom of the cell. And then because you can't have any fertilised eggs, the colony will collapse. So it's something you really have to look out for. That's why any sites I have, I always have two colonies, because if you run out of eggs in one colony, you can swap some eggs from one to the other colony and rescue them, or at least hopefully. A bee in its lifetime during the season will make less than a teaspoon of honey. So, I mean, that's not very much when you think of the amount of honey that we all eat. It's a very tiny amount, but a lot for a bee. I recommend buying local honey. If you do, you're going to get all the pollens in it. If you've got hay fever, that will really help. If you buy supermarket honey, you get a lot of honey that is blended. It could be overheated and overfiltered, so you won't get so many pollens in it. And it probably won't set. And a sign of a good local honey is one that will actually set. If you have it setting and you don't like set honey, you can actually warm it. If you want to put it in a saucepan on a very low heat with water up to the label and just warm it very gently, don't overheat it, but it will render the honey back to runny again, and then you can use it like that.
Thank you very much, Alec. That was just wonderful. I can't tell you. I'm really pleased that Julie and Jackie were sitting behind you, because when you started off telling us about the contretemps between the bee females and the bee males, they were barely able to contain their laughter. So, and all credit to them for doing that, because they really held it in. That was well done. But thank you very much. That was so informative. And I'm sure that the listeners at home learned just as much as we did. There was so much in there that none of us knew, and we were all agape, really, I think. So thank you very much for that, and I'm hoping that you will come and speak to us again sometime. But now it's time for the quiz, and here we go. What does an anemometer measure? That was number one. Number two is, what was a Snickers bar called before it was called Snickers? Number three, of which TV channel did David Attenborough become controller in March 1965? Number four, in the James Bond films, the officer who provides Bond with his lethal gadgets is known by what letter? What comes in French sash and bay varieties? Six, where is the Sea of Tranquility? Seven, multiple choice here. How many eyes does a bee have? Is it four or five? And number eight, what in pre-decimal coinage was a tanner? And I will be back later with the answers. Margaret King is here now with the first of our articles on the wonder of wildflowers.
Wildflowers. It all began a long time ago. When aged nearly seven, I was given by our next door neighbour a little book for Christmas. It was called Flower Fairies of the Summer, and was a selection of poems and beautiful illustrations by Cicely Mary Barker. Each flower had its own fairy, and its own poem. Looking now at the extremely dilapidated state of that same book, it is obvious that it was much loved and much used. In fact, in my childish handwriting, I have penciled in the names of my four dolls, Pauline, Joan, Jean, and Janet, under certain poems for them to perform, I imagine. The Flower Fairy books of summer, spring, autumn, plus many other settings, taught me an enormous lot about wildflowers and instilled in me a lifelong interest in them. As the years passed, the bookshelf began to bulge with an eclectic mix of wildflower books, many picked up at local sales. One very informative book for children, entitled A First Book of Wildflowers and published in 1927, expands on historical uses, strange names and properties, yet actively encourages the little children to go out into the countryside and gather large bunches of the many pretty, not the poisonous ones, of course, specimens. I somehow think that nowadays such sentiments are neither environmentally nor politically correct and would be heavily frowned upon. Published in the 70s and with exceedingly accurate illustrations, accompanied by precisely written details, is a book entitled The Wildflowers of Britain and Northern Europe. And this, for me, became the definitive go-to volume for identification. Thus, through all these books, together with countryside explorative walks, my knowledge increased. I learnt of the differing environments where wildflowers will grow. In woodlands, hedgerows, meadows, pasture land, cornfields, coasts, moors and mountains. Not that Suffolk offered much by way of the latter two. I came to appreciate seasonal changes and to find the autumnal fruits, often strangely different to the flowers. We all know the familiar names of the more common flowers, the daisies, bluebells, cowslips, buttercups, but I began to discover many more unusual names, toadflax, bird's foot trefoil, viper's bugloss, hound's tongue, rest harrow, traveller's joy, lady's smock, and scarlet pimpernel, which is also called the poor man's weather glass, to name just a few. Many names have hidden meanings, such as the forget-me-not, apparently the last words of a man who drowned whilst trying to pick one, and the dandelion, from the French dent de lion, as the jagged leaves resemble the teeth of a lion. Eventually, I kept a record of all I found. I'll mention here a small number of rarer discoveries, locally the common century, the orange hawkweed, the sticky catchfly, plus, further afield, a large bunch of deadly monkshood high up in Andorra, and in Provence, a really spectacular dense clump of lizard orchids. They are not at all pretty. Wildflowers have featured in all sorts of literature throughout the centuries. It was hard to bring something to mind until, whilst listening to Taylor Swift's brilliant homage song called The Fate of Ophelia, I remembered Ophelia's speech in Hamlet when she delivers symbolic herbs and flowers to those in the court. To quote it briefly, there's rosemary for remembrance, and there is pansies, that's for thought. There's fennel for you and columbines. There's rue for you, we may call it herb and grace o' Sundays. Ophelia, in her madness, drowns, either accidentally or by design, whilst picking wildflowers for a garland. The famous Pre-Raphaelite painter John Everett Millais, in his painting of the death of Ophelia, shows a number of flowers mentioned in Shakespeare's text, which have symbolic meanings, such as violets for faithfulness and poppies for death. Death, or near death, features in many wildflower stories as poison rears its ugly head. So take care with henbane, deadly nightshade, and monk's hood. I name but a few. I have a short story to tell. A few years ago, to be precise, August 11th, 2011, my daughter noticed from our bedroom window a very large white trumpet-shaped flower, together with a green, very spiky fruit, growing at the side of the adjacent field. It was easily identified as a thorn apple or devil's trumpet. The Latin name is Datura stramonium. When told of this discovery and shown the plant, the farmer was considerably concerned, to say the least, and he wondered whether the powers that be, in the manner of the archaeologists who descend when a Roman coin or mosaic is found, would be coming to shut down his business. Oh no, we said, very unlikely. However, there is a well-recorded story attached to this particular plant, which I must reiterate. Way back in 1676, when the British soldiers were stationed in Jamestown, Virginia, they were hungry and short on food, to which end they incorporated the large leaves of the thorn apple into a salad, with worrying consequences. For 11 full days they became complete idiots, babbling stupidly, grinning like monkeys, and behaving in a bizarre, nonsensical way. Eventually they recovered, and I believe remembered very little of the incident. Nevertheless, take heed of the hallucinogenic properties of the thorn apple. And by the way, it gathered yet another name, this time taken from where it all happened, Jamestown. It became known as the Jimson weed. And now, in conclusion, back to the present day and some happy news. The successfully run Green in Glemsford group, in conjunction with Eco Church, have taken over a large area of the older part of St Mary's Churchyard. This has become a wild area to encourage wildlife, flowers and plants. It is now roped off and a neat path has been cut so visitors can wander through. It is proven to be a popular sight. On my recent visit, I was pleased to see the healthy growth of primroses, ground ivy, oxlips, red and white dead nettle, cowslips, the locals call them peggles, and hiding shyly amongst the nettles, their purple heads drooping, a clump of snake's head fritillaries. A real wildflower meadow in the making.
Thank you, Margaret, for such an interesting and informative item. It provoked much discussion in the studio here, that thorn apple, which if you come across it, don't touch it, basically. Our next item is by John King, who shares his thoughts on wildflowers. John.
From my bedroom window, I can see many arable fields, one of which starts just the other side of my hedge. This year, the crop is wheat. The field was drilled in last autumn. It soon germinated and greened the field. It formed tufts, which they had set there for the winter, getting cold and waterlogged. As the days lengthened in spring, the crop grew rapidly and is still going very well indeed. Of course, the weeds in my garden are doing exactly the same thing. Every stem is the same length, there are no gaps in the crop, and it's uniform. This is a triumph of humans bringing control over nature. Of course, the crop has been sprayed several times to feed and control the unwanted weeds. Raising cultivars and then controlling the growing environment, arguably very necessary to feed a population of the world that has grown at a frightening rate. If you check the world population growth since only the 1950s, you will be very frightened. I must mention that many believe that the crops could be grown in a more organic manner. Whether or not that would give the yields, I do not actually know. The point of all this description is to highlight what is not there, that which would have coloured the spring back in the time of the Mayor of Casterbridge, namely the wildflowers within the crop, common poppies and drifts, cornflowers and corncockles, along with a myriad of other weeds and flowers. These can still be seen, of course, in organic fields which occasionally are grown. Of course, we can still find many wildflowers away from the fields, such as on the banks of country lanes, in the woods, and along green lanes. Fortunately, the widespread spraying of road vergers, which was common practice in the 70s, no longer happens. Hopefully, this is policy and not just another one of the things that no longer is done, like road markings. Mind you, roads are closed at the drop of a hat, with road closed signs appearing regularly. Back to the subject, which was wildflowers and not wild tempers. In about 1947, when I was 8, my Auntie Hetty was really good to me. There was not much about being just after the war, not many toys, not many of any of anything, really. She would take me out on summer evenings over the meadows, along the river bank and down country lanes. Despite the fact that as a young girl, she had sustained a broken hip, which was not well repaired in those days. Of course, at that time, there were barely any traffic. It was a different world then. On some walks, we would gather wildflowers and press them between the pages of exercise books. I had two books, and they were kept for many years. In fact, I thought I still had them, but thus far, all attempts to locate them have failed. I can remember that there were the get-me-nots, wild willow herb, loosestrife, red and white campions, and meadow sweet. A prize token to press was an iris, dangerous together, very near the river, so I never collected them. We owned no fancy flower press, just the flowers arranged carefully between the pages and a weight, paper, heavy weight placed on the top of the book for a while. Not always successful. It is amazing that I can remember and collect those flowers and the pleasure I derived from it all those years ago, but now I'm not quite sure why I left the cup of tea. The peal of wildflowers, which so brightens our world, has for many years now led to girls being given names of flowers. We have had Daisy, Iris, Violet, Rose, Lily, Daphne, Myrtle, Rosemary, and of course the now very popular Poppy. Had this trend been caught on for boys, then it becomes food for speculation. How about Thistle, or Burdock, or Nettle? He'd be called Stinger, wouldn't he?
Thank you, John, for sharing your memories of flower walks with Auntie Hetty and the flower presses. So you always give us such a descriptive and delightful trip down memory lane. And this one just happened to be flowers, wildflower strewn. So thank you. Julie Thompson now shares her springtime observations of present-day Sudbury. Julie.
Well, hello there. It's so nice to be back with you again. I often wonder what you look like if you're listening to this recording alone, sat in your comfy armchair with a cat on your lap, or perhaps you're doing the ironing, washing up, or even walking down the street with a pair of headphones on. How many of you have risked taking your USB stick and speaker out into the garden now that spring has well and truly sprung? I can't think of a nicer thing to do on a warm, sunny day. Who knows, the busy blue tits rushing around finding food for their recently hatched chicks might enjoy the dulcet tones of our volunteer contributions. But sitting outside in the garden, on a warm spring day is like food for the soul. The light has changed somehow. The grey, heavy, oppressive skies of the winter months can really affect our mood, but now they are diminishing, replaced by the bright azure blue with white clouds. It brings hope and optimism for the year ahead. Snowdrops have been and gone and the bluebells are past their best, but the clematis and iris are in their full glory. I can see the Sudbury water meadows from my bedroom window. And one morning, about a month ago, I saw an odd thing. Two mature ladies with two small dogs on leads, almost running across the meadow. They were not in jogging attire. And to be honest, they didn't look like they were the jogging sort. But there they were, proceeding with some urgency in the direction of the exit to the road. I turned to my husband and said, "That's odd. I've just seen two of the most unlikely joggers, each with a dog on a lead, over there, running across the meadows." But before he could respond, what did I see but a perfect line of at least 15 beautiful, bouncing black bullocks bounding after the two ladies and their dogs. No wonder they were running. Another reminder that spring had arrived, because the cows were back on the common lands. Another thing I love about spring is the birdsong. I'm sure you do too. Now, I don't profess to know too much about our feathered friends, but I can recognise the robin's song and that of the blackbird. But the others, well, they get names like the peep, 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 peep bird, because that's what it sounds like. I really love the sound and sight of a wren, or a Jenny Wren, as I've always called them. That made me wonder if I was the only person who called them that. So I carried out a little research on the internet, and it told me that the name dates back to at least the mid-1600s, often used in nursery rhymes. It was part of a tradition of applying human names to animals, similar to Tom Tit or Jackdaw. And in folklore, the wren was considered the female counterpart to the cock robin, often referred to as God's almighty hen. Tiny and perfect little bird. And the word wren, W-R-E-N-N-E, in Middle English means little tail. She's a quick, busy and elusive bird, which was often playfully personified as a small, lively female Jenny. And finally, the term Jenny Wren was popularised through stories including a character in Charles Dickens' Our Mutual Friend and in the 2005 song Jenny Wren by Paul McCartney. But I'll end with my hopes for the group of starlings that have been spending a lot of time on the water meadows. Now, they are quite a gang. I should imagine about 30 of them, busying themselves, feeding, flying, and with their collection of vocal whistles, rattles, squawks and trills. I'm hoping that they will make this place their home, and then I've got something wonderful to look forward to in the winter time. At the end of the year, we might just be treated to the spectacular aerial display that takes place around dusk, as the birds gather in large numbers to roost, creating wonderful patterns in the darkening sky, before plummeting at speed, like a dropped stone, to their place of safety and rest. A murmuration. But I've murmured on enough, so I'll say goodbye for now, and do take the time to enjoy the nature on your doorstep this spring.
Thank you, Julie, for sharing the springtime view from your bedroom window and for reminding us that winter has its high points too. And now back with those quiz answers. Question one was, what does an anemometer measure? And that's wind speed. Question two, Snickers were called marathon bars before being unnecessarily rebranded, in my view. Three, David Attenborough became controller of BBC Two on the condition that he could continue to make the odd TV programme, which is great for us. Number four, Q was, of course, the officer who provides Bond with his lethal gadgets. And he was played by a number of actors, but most notably Desmond Llewelyn and Ben Whishaw. Number five, French, sash and bay are varieties of window. Number six, the Sea of Tranquility is on the moon, and obviously it doesn't contain water, so I don't know why it's called a sea. Number seven, how many eyes does a bee have? And you had the choice of four or five. And it turns out that bees have five eyes, two compound eyes on either side of their head, and three single eyes in a triangle formation on the top of the head. And I'm just swivelling round to check with Alex that that's correct. And it is indeed correct. Number eight. In pre-decimal coinage, a tanner was a sixpence, and that's 2.5 new pence in the newfangled currency. So I hope you did better in the studio at home than they did in the studio. I feel like I'm obliged to say that. And finally, we join Jackie McSweeney, who is here with a piece to stir all our senses and mark the return of spring royalty. Jackie.
Thank you. Ah, at last, spring. In 1986, a band called The released an album called The Colour of Spring, one of my favourites. And as I listened to it recently, it made me wonder not just about the colours, but also about the smells and sounds of my favourite season, spring. Spring does not simply arrive, it unfolds. It lengthens itself into the world the way light stretches across a room at dawn, slowly, deliberately, touching everything before it fully reveals its presence. It is the season that teaches patience. It starts with the smallest things, a morning that feels like a shade lighter. A breeze that doesn't sting. The air carries that freshness that makes me pause without knowing why. I step outside and suddenly I'm aware of my own shoulders, how they've been hunched for months, how they drop a little without my permission. Spring does that. It softens you before you've even agreed to be softened. Winter's breath is sharp, almost metallic. But spring is soft and damp, scented with thawing soil and the faint sweetness of blossoms still gathering courage as cherry, hawthorn, apple and magnolia buds loosen, light and floral, never overwhelming. The earth smells like it has been turned over in sleep and is now waking, stretching and remembering itself. Even the rain changes character. It no longer falls with winter's cold indifference. Instead, it lands with a warm insistence. There's a moment every year when I hear the first real birdsong of spring, a cuckoo, and it hits me in a way I can't quite explain. It's not just a sound. It's a reminder that something in me is waking up too. Winter quietens my emotions, makes everything feel muted and distant, but spring brings them back, gently but undeniably. It's like something turning up the volume on feelings I'd set aside for later. Then come the colours, not all at once, but in careful, thoughtful gestures. A haze of green appears first, so subtle you might miss it if you blink. Buds swell on branches like tiny held breaths. Crocuses and daffodils push through the soil with a kind of quiet determination, their colours bright enough to feel almost defiant. Spring paints the world slowly, layering pastels before daring to reach for brilliance. It's a season that understands the power of anticipation.
Sound returns slowly, like an orchestra tuning. A single bird tries a note, then another answers, and soon the morning is threaded with dawn choruses that feel like the world is waking up with you, both ancient and brand new. The wind softens too. It no longer scrapes across bare branches. It rustles through new leaves, making a music that winter could never manage. Even the hum of distant life, footsteps, bicycles, voices, seem to gather and be gentler, as though people instinctively lower their volume out of respect for the season's awakening. Spring is not without its imperfections, but even these feel tender. Mud clings to boots. Rain interrupts plans. The sun hesitates behind clouds as if shy about its return. Yet these small inconveniences are part of the season's charm. They remind us that renewal is rarely neat. Growth is messy. Beginnings are often damp and uncertain. But they are beginnings all the same. Set spring apart from the other seasons is its emotional temperature. Winter teaches endurance, the art of holding on. Autumn teaches acceptance, the grace of letting go. Summer demands energy, the insistence on living loudly. But spring teaches hope. Not the triumphant kind that arrives with fanfare, but the quiet, persistent kind that grows leaf by leaf, birdsong by birdsong. It is the hope that returns even after the longest cold, the kind that does not need to be loud to be powerful. Spring is the only season where sound feels like a welcome companion rather than a demand on your attention. We are so lucky to have spring in our seasons. So throw open your windows and smell it. Walk outside and listen to it singing. Enjoy all for its pleasures, for soon it will be summer, then autumn, and then the long winter, before spring once again emerges from its slumber. Thank you.
Thank you, Jackie, for a supremely meditative, beautifully read and beautifully written piece. I knew I wanted to finish on that, so thank you very much. I have a challenge for our listeners and a preview is the wrong word for our contributors, but following a suggestion from one of our VIP visually impaired person listeners, I am going to tell you what the topic for the next magazine will be and invite listeners to send something in if they are inspired to do so. As I say always to our contributors, this is just a jumping off point. So if it doesn't inspire you and there's something else you'd like to write about, please do. We'd love to hear from our listeners. So the topic is very simple. It's a day out in Suffolk. Now, if you would prefer to write about a day out outside Suffolk or anywhere else at all, or anything else at all, please do. But the principal topic is a day out in Suffolk. If you'd like to send a piece for inclusion, could you please get it to us by the 24th of June, which is a Wednesday? If it's on paper, it can be returned in your memory stick return wallet. If you would like some assistance to get to contribute something to the magazine, you can contact Trevor Green, or again, you can put a note in the wallet and we will get in touch with you and give you every assistance we can to get your piece into the magazine for next time or the time after that, perhaps. Anyway,
Thank you very much for listening. It's been a pleasure. I can honestly say that this has been one of the most fun recordings in a long time. Thank you very much to listening. Thanks very much to all of our volunteers for the wonderful contributions, and to Alec Wisby for giving us such a fascinating insight into the life of bees, really. And also to our fantastic technician, Trevor Green. And until next time, goodbye. Bye.